LNE Volume 3, a video by the great Franklin Carbonati, spanning Rome, Milan, London, New York, Paris, Barcelona, Montreal, and Toronto, featuring Rebo, Volvo, Snens, MTNW, Anger, Talker, Xavier, BO South, Lure, Rehab, Time, Zonic, XSM, Kemto, Salon, TD, Emno, Fayer, Toser, Nove, Stays, Villo, OSF, Waste, Soul, Zano, Guko, and What. The full video is now available on our Patreon. Enjoy. Peace, love, and respect.
Peace, everybody. So we started this podcast a year ago, and since then, all the support we've gotten and the following we've been able to amass has been honestly crazy to us. But our ultimate aim is not just to entertain people, but we want to use this platform to be able to give back to society and give back to the world around us to make the world a less horrible place to be living in. I'm sure we all know that we live in a world that honestly does not always prize the things that we do. And if your passions don't align with the things that the world prizes, you're going to find it very hard to make a real living in this life. So from writers who are in prison and have legal fees to longstanding businesses that are closing down because of things like gentrification and rising rent prices, to foundations and charities that help ex-inmates get back on their feet because they can't get a good job since they've been in prison and have an arrest record now. This is what we're going to be giving back to, and we're going to be starting with Charlie the Hustler. So we're making a Patreon account, and we're going to be using the funds to be helping and to be giving back to all of these things that were just named. First month is going to be Charlie the Hustler, and he's somebody who's helped us beyond belief. I'm sure a lot of you know he has not had an easy life. He was our first episode, and he sacrificed his life for graffiti completely. I don't know where we'd be without that dude's help, so he needs our help right now, and we're going to be returning the favor in full force. 100% of the proceeds will be going to Charlie the Hustler because he's living off of the grid in an RV and needs our help. He's in a bind.
But if you sign up for our Patreon, along with just helping out, you'll be getting early access to Les, YKK, and Lot 29 full episodes.
They're already up right now on our Patreon. The link is in our bio, and the link is also on our website. Also, everybody who signs up is going to get a Charlie the Hustler eggshell die-cut sticker pack. It's three of Charlie's throwies. Each of them has a different design, and we're also going to be throwing extra shit here and there. So, yo, to everybody who listens, anybody who's messaged us, commented, anything, followed us, listened to an episode, I mean, even if you shit on us, yo, for real, it means the world to us. This has been nothing but crazy to me and Z, and we cannot explain how hyped we are that all of this is going down. So at the end of each month, the proof of the donation that we make will be posted on our story, and just peace and respect. Thank you so much, everybody. Enjoy the episode.
All right, cool. So yeah, I'm gonna try to make this ever so slightly different than some of the other podcasts you've done. So I'm just gonna start it off with a quote from your book, that your last chapter, when you speak on death. And what you said was that death is one of the most dreaded words in the English dictionary because everyone fears it, even the bravest men. But it's the inevitable outcome of every living thing, and no one knows when, where, and how. But with each passing day, it creeps closer and closer. And to fear it is meaningless. Instead, you must learn to accept it unconditionally and be strong. Everyone must accept that it is inevitable and unavoidable and must be prepared for when their time comes. Be prepared to face it like a man, knowing in your heart that it can't be avoided, and accept that it is one of the many things in life that can't be changed. For me, rather than the fear of dying, my fear is the way that I will die. Rather than my life being taken by some meaningless circumstance, if I had the chance to die for someone I loved, without a split second of hesitation, I would jump at the chance, even if it was tomorrow. If I could take a bullet in the heart for one of my Ichizoku, there would be absolutely no hesitation at what I would do. I would proudly stand tall with pride in my heart, take the bullet in my heart, and die with a smile on my face, knowing that my life didn't end in a meaningless way. My life was sacrificed for a loved one whose life will go on because of my noble actions. and dying is much easier than watching a loved one go, giving your life for an Ichizoku. To me, there is no better way to die. You know, there's like a lot that you've done in your life, and like kind of like since the beginning, since like your situation where you watched your friend get bullied and it like touched you deep in your heart. That is, for me, like reading your book and just like knowing the history behind you and your mixed martial arts fights and like the philosophy that you live your life with, it seems like your life has been really shaped by this ideology. Do you think that this came from? Do you believe that like it's just something that was destiny and meant to happen, that your spirit has these thoughts? Or
I've been asked this before, yeah, and I don't think I can really pinpoint how I formed this type of belief and type of loyalty and, you know, feeling towards a family. But not sure where it actually started, but through the situations that I had in my life, you know, people turning their back on me, people showing loyalty towards me, I think it's really made the whole feeling concrete. And I feel like it's as life goes on, as I get older, I'm understanding it more. I mean, you know, it's hard because the loyalty and the way I live my life isn't normal. And I do want to, especially, you know, the loyalty, speaking of loyalty, the loyalty that I live, I mean, you know how I say I die for someone that I call family tomorrow. Yeah, I mean, that's not a, there won't be a hesitation in my movement to die for someone that I call family. And the sad thing is throughout the years, there's every other year or so, I find out a person that I thought was family, and that there's some kind of situation in our life that comes up, and I realize that, holy shit, their loyalty isn't the loyalty that I give them. You know how it's, you know, any type of respect or loyalty is not something that you just get. It has to be reciprocated. And I had a guy, you know, just that I thought was my brother for over a couple of decades. There was a situation that happened that I realized that, wow, it's not someone that I can call family anymore. And yeah, I don't think, the thing with me, I think I believe I understand that the values that I have for you know, the family, the loyalty is super, very, very high. The it's a real hard thing to carry. So the people who can aren't bad. They're normal. But I just want to make sure that people that are around me are people that carry that same loyalty, that if there's a bullet coming, we'd be fighting each other on who takes it.
Yeah, that's funny that you say that about how it's not necessarily normal, and the people who don't feel like that aren't necessarily bad. They're normal, because I was thinking from an outsider's perspective, if you don't really have like a deeper grasp of this ideology of like the give it all you have until the end and die for your family and friends type of thinking, you would look at this, and especially some of the things that you yourself have done, and you would think to yourself as an outsider, this person just simply doesn't care about his own life. That's what the thought process might be. The first thing, like, for example, one thing that comes to mind is like when you had that fight with Igor Vovchanchnin, and you're very aware that you're stepping into, like, there is a more intelligent way to go about this fight that would secure your safety more, but instead you decide to take the harder route and just go essentially, you know, trade shots. Someone would say that, well, this person doesn't care about their own life. What do you have to say about that?
People who feel that, which is probably the majority of the people, I think that they just don't understand that there is more than a physical life. There's a spiritual life too. And the ones that think that I'm reckless or stupid, they probably visualize, they just live the physical life is everything to them, living and dying. But I feel that all the things you do in your physical life will create how and where and your status in the spiritual life. So, a lot of it is integrity. You know, when you say, if I go to the fight and then, you know, it looks like I'm giving everything I got, but I know inside I'm not. I feel like I'm cheating myself the opportunity to grow and the opportunity to spiritually grow. So, you know, the fights, you know, it's like, why don't you just take Igor down and get on top and use your ground that you're probably better than striking at? It all depends on the objective of the person stepping into the ring, yeah? So if your objective is to win the fight, then of course that would be the prime thing to do, is to take Igor down and fight him on the ground, because I think my ground's better than Igor's. But my objective was to test myself as a man. And to do that, the first step was to step into the fear zone that Igor creates. And I think before I fought Igor, the fight that made me want to fight Igor was Francisco Bueno. I think it was a couple prides before my pride with Igor. And Igor knocked him out cold. And on the way down, he hit him again. I mean, the first punch rolled Francisco Bueno's eyes out. And Francisco Bueno was probably 30 pounds bigger than me. And as Francis Bueno was falling down with his eyes rolled back, Igor hit him again. And I remember it real distinctly because I was in the second row of the arena and his girlfriend, wife was three seats down from us and she was screaming bloody murder. And the bloody murder turned to tears and like a real wailing cry, because he was down for a long time and not moving. So we were even thinking holy shit, this guy's down for a while. I hope he's okay. And the way she was going off on it, I mean, you know, it kind of passes your mind. Is this guy going to make it or what? Is he going to die? And right there, I thought, man, that to stand in front of Igor and throw punches with him, that fear zone would be so, so strong that what would I want to run? Would I want to hide? Would I be able to stand there and be strong? And I had this little mission in my life to go in and stand toe-to-toe with Igor.
I was going to say, because I seen an interview where you did after the fight. It seemed like sometime after it, and the guy asked you, you know, what made you go toe-to-toe with him? And you said, aside from technique, you realized in that fight that you can overcome anything now. So it seems to you like... It's a personal thing, these fights. It's not more about the opponent. It's more what you can overcome. Do you think following a spiritual path, you live more in the moment, as to a regular person might think about the future, the consequences of doing this? You think that's a strong thing in your beliefs, living more in the moment?
Well, living in the moment is trying to think about my future. If I can stand toe-to-toe with Igor and become a stronger person, it'll help me in the future. That's what I feel. And, you know, it's every fight the reason why I went in the ring wasn't to win titles, wasn't to become famous, wasn't to make money. The reason why I went into the ring, because I wanted to test myself as a man. And it started off as simple as a man-to-man, hand-to-hand, two men standing across each other in the ring in combat. I mean, I played racquetball before and I've had the nerves change my shots and make me I couldn't be practice ensign, couldn't be tournament ensign. So I knew it was the nerves. I knew I had to learn to control my nerves, and to control my nerves wasn't just for me to control it for sports, but it was also I need to control it for life in the situations in real day life. I don't want to be freaking out and panicking if someone that I love gets shot and I had to either make a tourniquet or I have to stick my hand in the cut to stop the bleeding. I want to be level-headed. So for me, it was all about that. You know, it's all about learning. And the reason why I went in the ring is I felt that it's like the perfect opportunity to get as close as you can to a life in this situation and learn how to react to it. You know, you can play sports and racquetball and everything, but there's nothing like standing across the ring from a professional fighter that has trained 3 months to learn how to hurt you enough that you can't continue, or you, or the referee or people watching thinks it's dangerous and they jump in and stop it. And my whole fight, my whole career was on that mission. And, you know, I always, you know, it's funny because it's really different nowadays when you hear Conor McGregor saying, I can beat him in the second round, or oh, this guy's nothing. I'll walk over him. He's easy. He's an easy fight. But they asked to fight him. I mean, you know, their deal is to get a win, pad the record, become as, I mean, I roll my eyes every time the fighters talk about the GOAT being the GOAT. It's like, fuck, who gives a shit? You're never going to know if a prime, you know, Conor McGregor was the same size as Mark Coleman, if he would be able to beat him. It's like, it's a fantasy. And you're never going to be able to know who's actually really the GOAT. It's going to be a whole opinionated. So, you know, these guys are all trying to do that. I'm on this deeper mission on growth as a human being, as a man. And I'm picking every single fight that I took, besides the ones that had to fill because someone with Mark Kerr was hurt or something, was all about guys that I thought would either break me or put me into that zone where I'd have to have this moment where I have to decide if I'm going to be strong or not. Mm-hmm. In life, there's this thing I call the Yamato Damashi moment. Okay. You guys have it in your life. And if you can recognize it, it'll help you grow. What Yamato Damashi moment is a moment in your life that you really think like, holy shit, I can't continue. And for you and me, it's going to be two different things. Yeah. For a F1 race driver, is going to be different for me, because if I jump in that freaking car and he starts going at 200 miles towards the turn, and I'm thinking, when is he going to slow down to turn? I'll be freaking out and want to press the brake. But he doesn't fear that. So when you watch my Igor fight, I was planning to stand toe-to-toe with him. So I faked the tackle, threw it overhand right, and then from there, you notice I grabbed him. I grabbed him and I hugged him. And I, for a moment there, I got scared. And I was like, holy shit. I don't know if I want to throw at this guy. I started remembering what he did to all the other guys that they threw down with. And you look at that moment, it probably lasted about 2 seconds where he kind of tried to spin me off. For me, it lasted like a minute. And I was in that... And right there, in that instance, I knew that for me, it was a Yamato Damashi moment. And if you notice, I broke away on my own and started to throw blow for blow. So, you know, if you, like, in your office, you know, you have a job and your boss comes and tells you, you got to do this. And it's like, you're sitting there like, man, I think I got to fucking tell him, no, I can't do this. I don't know if I can do this. And you really believe in your heart that, shit, I don't think I can do this. And then you decide, boom, I'm going to fucking do it. That's like overcoming a Yamato Damashi moment. And for me, you know, man, almost every fight I went into, there was an instance where I had to deal with that.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, you talk about that in your book. And I think that that's something that's very important and can be, you know, it's something that is a daily life thing. And I like that you say that it's not just if you're in the ring fighting with someone, because it depends on the person. I often think about this when someone might look at someone who, let's say, does a lot of push-ups every morning, and they think like, wow, so much. I think about it in terms of discipline. They say like, so much discipline. But really, for that person, that is really does not take much discipline for them, because they enjoy it. So their push-ups to them is like zero discipline needed. Just like someone who, let's say, maybe they enjoy watching movies, they don't need discipline to watch a movie. It's easy for them. So it's not on the same factor, just how, like, essentially a Yamato Damashi moment is like overcoming something within yourself. Like, maybe I like eating vegetables, so it doesn't take me much to do this, whereas someone else, it would be the most difficult thing in their life, and to do that thing would take everything in their soul and really like a changing of their being to get to that moment. I think that that's something important, because when you, you know, like you see these videos and you hear about Yamato Damashi spirit and fighting until the end, you might think, as a person who is not into martial arts, which not everybody is, you might think, wow, like, I can't do that. I could never reach that that point. But I think that it's something that if you really strive for, it's accessible regardless of what your hobby is, regardless of what you do. You can level up, because it's really about, you know, leveling up your own spirit within yourself. And I think that's something super important that should and can be applied to, you know, every single day life. But just to reiterate, because it was before that I started recording that you said this, for the people who are listening and don't know, can you explain real quick what Yamato Damashi is as a whole, and where that name came from?
Okay, Yamato Damashi, long ago in Japan, Yamato meant Japan, and Tamashi meant spirit. It means spirit. So the Yamato, this kanji means Japan, long ago Japan. It just means spirit. And by long ago Japan, we're meaning like the era where samurai ran through Japan. So there's the spirit of the samurai is translated to. And you know, the thing with the Yamato Damashi, it's what the reason why I really at first when I was introduced to the word, where the one of the reporters called me Yamato Damashi, said, when I see you fight and I hear you talk, it reminds me of Yamato Damashi. When I first taught that, I thought, oh, because I want to go in and brawl, and I'm ready to stand toe to toe till I get knocked out, you know. But as I was, you know, looking up the word, because they kind of named me that word, I kind of wanted to know the deeper meaning of the word. Even, you know, when I meet people that are like in their 80s or 90s, I'll sit down and talk to them. Like, what does Yamato Damashi mean to you? Because that's the real meaning of Yamato Damashi. You know, it not only encompasses being tough, it's about, you know, compassion for others, you know, protecting the weak, helping others. It's about loyalty. It's about courage. There's so many good aspects of Yamato Damashi. It's amazing, because when I went, there's two instances that I want to point out. Is once I went into a restaurant to eat, and there was a very elder lady serving us. So I kind of looked at her and I said, were you alive during the World War? And she said, well, yeah, I was a little girl. So I asked her, Yamato Damashi, what does that mean to you? She goes, and she almost got a little upset. She looked at me, it's just not. It's gone. The word is gone. I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, people don't know the word. The word has died. And I was like, whoa, like, oh, she was like, really, like, whoa. And, you know, I look back, and when I first started making the shirts to wear the Yamato Damashi on my chest as a proud person, I used to get laughed at it from the Japanese kids, and, you know, showing obviously that they don't understand what Yamato Damashi is. And then there's another time in a TV station, I'm taking a pee and a urine. I'm actually telling you what was going on. So it's weird that I'm telling you I'm taking a pee, but I was taking a pee in a urinal, had a guy next to me, an older guy, and he looked over and he goes, ah, instantly noe. And I was like, oh, domo, thank you, thank you. And he goes, thank you, he told me. I said, whoa. I said, what do you mean, thank you? He goes, thank you for bringing the word back to life. And I was like, wow. So it meant a lot to me, man. Mm-hmm. And when I started reading up more on Yamato Damashi, Yamato Damashi was a word that if you go to the museum in Shinjuku, where had a lot of the kamikaze pilots during the World War, all in their letters to their family, they're writing Yamato Damashi, Yamato Damashi. And that word was really prevalent within the Japanese during that time. But when they lost the war to the United States, they were forbidden to say that word. They were forbidden to talk proudly of the United States, I mean, of Japan. So like Yamato Damashi was like the Japanese spirit. They were forbidden to say that kind of stuff. So that man, I guess, in the urinals was telling me that, you know, he's happy that I brought it back.
Yeah, and you talk about how when like a Yamato Damashi moment in your life is something that is rare. And when it comes up, you shouldn't, there's like a rare moment in a person's life where they have this like spiritual moment where they can really, you can feel a different energy. You can feel a different something in your spirit that is making you aware that this is happening as we speak? Like, for example, for you, like the Igor moment, in that moment when you're holding him and you realize there's fear in my heart, which means like this is the rare opportunity in my life that might pass me by if I don't take full advantage of it. And, you know, you were telling your corner beforehand, no stopping it. And you were talking about how, so I think he was on top. Maybe he was in your clothes guard, or he was just like, you know, really hitting you. And you said you, and the whole time you were also on the attack, when maybe the smart thing to do would be try to control his posture, stop those blows. And you're like, fuck that. Or even when you fought, what's his name? The Randy Couture. And you're on the floor and you're legitimately the aggressor. Like, you're playing open guard essentially in an MMA fight, and you're actively the aggressor. You're coming up doing flying kicks that are like attempting to, and like slapping on his shoulder super hard. And it's like, you're really using these moments to elevate yourself. You have this concept of a winning versus losing, and about how winning is not, like, a win is just a word, essentially. It doesn't necessarily mean you won anything as besides the record keeping. A win can be like a loss, and a loss can be like a win, depending on like how you take it. You talk about that. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, a win. It depends on what you're trying to win at. Yeah. So most people nowadays, a win is getting your arm raised in the ring at the end of the fight, getting that first place trophy, getting that gold medal. That's a win. But I feel like that's a real superficial win. For me, the win isn't whether my hand is raised in the ring or not. It's if the outcome of the experiences that I get in the ring, whether winning or losing, whether victory or defeat in the sport sense happens, my true victory will be if I can become a stronger man or a better fighter the next time I step into the ring. So after the fight is over, winning or losing, whether my hand is raised or not, I'm still going back and saying, okay, what did I do wrong? How did I learn? What have I overcome to make me a stronger person? And when I can cover all that, understand that, and then correct my mistakes, and know in my heart, the next time I step in the ring, I'm a better fighter, that was a victory. So, you know, the victory for me isn't after the fight. It's a couple weeks after the fight, maybe sometimes a month, maybe a year after I realize what I did and what I learned from. And then I've absorbed what I've going to correct, and then step into the ring and become a stronger person or a better fighter.
I think you would have been able to reach these levels of your spirit without martial arts? Do you think that martial arts has given you an avenue to learn something more than just knowing how to throw some punches and kicks and grappling techniques? What has martial arts done for you outside of learning how to just do basic self-defense?
Martial arts has pushed me as a man to learn about myself, to learn how to face fears. It also helped me discipline, learn how to push through pain, and even be able to overcome impossible situations. You know, I didn't overcome them all. You know, everyone told me I'm going to get my ass kicked from Randy Couture. I didn't. Everyone told me not to fight Mark Kerr. He's gonna hurt you. He didn't hurt me. You know, so. Well, even, you know, the Heath Hearing fight, when he had me in my arm in the key lock, everyone was saying that I should tap, but I didn't. And, you know, there's so much in fighting that the experience that I had that would have, I don't know, in normal life, man, for something about fighters, we're lucky, man. We get pushed to a very extreme point in fear, physical pain, mental anguish, in training, in the fights, that I feel we're so lucky. We got so much time to grow as, you know, a warrior, as a person, as a man, than some normal person that just doing a 9-to-5 job in the office. And fighting has made me who I am, not just from the fame and my name, the person that I am today. And I'm forever embedded to fighting. That's why when I do seminars, you know, all over the world, because I want to give back to fighting. I do, you know, you guys are tools that are helping MMA be what it is. You know, people used to think it's just a human cockfighting. But you guys doing these interviews and these podcasts are bringing to light to people that, wow, these guys have a meaning in why they're doing things. They're not barbaric guys. And you guys are promoting the sport that who has made me who I am. And that's why I do all the podcasts, is because I appreciate what you guys are doing for the sport that has made me who I am. I really don't know what I'd be without, if I didn't come across fighting. I don't even know what kind of man I would be. I don't even know what kind of job I'd be doing. I love the life I live. I love the person I've become. And I'm proud of the man that I've become. And it's all because of fighting.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that. Yeah, I agree completely, because to an outsider, you know, martial arts or seeing someone train, they might think it's just brute aggression, violence, almost like a negative energy in a way, like, oh, look at this tough guy, you know, like it's a very like shallow thing, you know. But from my experience, when I started jiu-jitsu, I've noticed the situations that I've been in after that have been progressively calmer, because, for example, like if I would be at work and like my superior or whatever, like, you know, would get me angry, or someone I would work with get me frustrated before, I would overthink it. It would ruin my day, you know. Now I can approach it in a more peaceful way, or I can be in a chaotic moment on the streets or like in traffic, for example, and someone cuts me off, or you can tell that the person almost wants to escalate the situation. But since I trained jiu-jitsu, it like brings me to the state of mind of like peace in the chaos, you know, like it's not worth it, like it doesn't matter, you know what I mean? And if there is a situation where I feel like, you know, you can almost freeze up because it's too much, you can now think rationally. You can, like, in the midst of the chaos, you're like, oh, I'm going to think of a technique to get out of this, you know? It's amazing what martial arts does. And like you said, I think the regular person should see it more than what it is, you know, from just on TV, you know, like you see, brought up Conor McGregor, like the regular person thinks it's just this boastful sport. But I remember someone asked you, who's your favorite MMA fighter? And you thought Khabib, because he's humble, he's honorable, what a real martial artist should be. Like the true Budo spirit is just calm and peaceful and only speak when you should be speaking. You know what I mean? It's really sick.
Well, it's interesting what you say, is because I've got into 10 times, 100 times more street fights that I've been in 100 times more street fights than after starting fight. After I started training jiu-jitsu and everything, I think I've got into almost zero street fights after that. And, you know, martial arts has helped me, you know. See, martial arts isn't just, there are some barbaric assholes that are just being tough, you know. Of course, there's those. There's also people who are just taking it for self-defense. But martial arts is a way to, people need to understand, is it's not just about fighting or beating people up. It's not just about self-defense, protecting yourself. It's about growing as a person, man. There's so much growing you can do in martial arts as a man, as a person.
Absolutely. And you should take what you learn and apply it outside of martial techniques, so you can get what I think is the full experience and the full benefit of what it is exactly that you're learning. And one of the big things is your mindset. And you talk about how the different mindset can make the same situation look very different to two different people, or even the same person. And you bring up the example of the plank of steel or plank of wood, and you put it across a mat, and you tell a group of people, maybe you walk from here across the plank and you pick up $100 bill that's at the other end and you get to keep it. And of course, I do it no problem because it's on the floor. And the moment you put it, maybe connecting two eight-story buildings, they're not going to be able to do that anymore. And it's because their mindset and specifically their focus has changed as to what it is they're focused on. In terms of the not tapping when your arm breaks, and how there's essentially just like, it was like three fighters including you, that have really been willing to do that in like a historic way in the moment. Like that photo of Henzo where his just arm is just completely the wrong way. He's just looking at it like he doesn't, it is not really a factor. Another thing, like the common conception is pure ego of not wanting to tap in the moment. What is the approach? What is your perception of what is actually happening as opposed to just pure ego of victory?
For me, when I fought, people like to say this, and I see a lot of fighters saying this, but they, at the first sign of danger, they start tapping. They all say that I'm ready to die. When I decided to fight, for the 3 months that I'm training not to die. I accept in my heart that the fight that I'm fighting next, I'm willing to die in the ring. So when I'm training the 3 months, my mindset is already set that the harder you train, the less chances of dying. And I train thinking that this might be my last day. You know, if I say, for example, my fight is on the 15th, and I have someone come up to me when we meet them outside and say, hey, on the 18th, we have a party, man. You got to come check it out. The first thing that goes through my mind is like, fuck, man. I tell them, yeah, okay, shoot, man. Okay, I'll be there, man. And I'm thinking to myself in my head, like, holy shit. If the 18 comes and I'm driving to the party, it's a freaking good day because that means I didn't die in the ring. That's how much I was accepting the fact that I might not be around after the 15. And think about it. When you're accepting that extreme, a broken arm is nothing. Going to sleep is nothing. So when my mindset set so strongly on willing to die, as long as my mindset doesn't falter and get scared and fear take over and I'm like, oh shit, I don't want my arm to break and I start tapping. As long as I stay focused, as long as my mindset is strong and I think I'm still alive. Oh fuck, my arm's snapping. Have you ever seen anyone die from a broken arm? No. So I'm fine. You know, I get choked out. I'm getting choked out. Fuck. People say, you know, people that tap from chokes, you know, do you know why people tap from chokes? Yeah. It's not because it's painful. If you do jiu-jitsu, you know chokes aren't painful. It's freaking scary that you can't really breathe. And of course, it's a fearful thing to go unconscious. And I believe the reason why people tap from chokes is not because of pain, it's because of the anticipation of what they think is going to happen. So when the choke's in and you can't even say mommy, you can't even say your own name, you know, it's like it's coming in and you start getting lightheaded. Right there, a lot of, for the normal person, fear kicks in. Like, oh, fuck, I'm going to go unconscious. And I don't want to go unconscious because it looks like I died. But for me, it's, you know, because I'm so focused and willing to die, I'm willing to have the most extreme thing happen to me in the ring. A broken arm, getting choked out, is not going to falter my mindset. So when I went, got choked out from probably the first time and only time I got choked out from Nogueira, I remember the triangle sinking in. I remember it being tight. And I'm thinking, okay, I think I was trying to kick him in the head or something. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I got to relax. I got to relax. I got to let blood flow through my head. And and the whole time, you know, no one in the world, if you guys ever been choked out before, no one knows when they're going to go to sleep. Everyone has a different threshold. Yeah. You never can say, okay, I know I'm going to sleep in 1 second. I'm going to tap. Nobody knows that. People tap before they go to sleep because they're anticipating their fear of what they think is going to happen. So for me, it was like, okay, oh shit, I gotta get, and before I knew it, I was like, oh shit, Egan standing above me. I'm like, damn, I must have went to sleep, you know. So that also gave me a real strong feeling of, you know, spiritual growth, yeah, because till the moment that I went to sleep, I was trying to find out a way how to get out of the triangle. I was trying to find a way to get out. I was trying to find a way to get back and try and hurt him back. So, you know, I mean, I think for me, you know, not tapping isn't being tough. It isn't this ability to deal with pain. It's just the fact that my mind and my heart was set. I had such a strong mindset that I am willing to die today. You know, before all my fights, you know, I'd write little notes to people that I really cared about. And it was just words that I wanted to say to them to make my death easier so that they don't feel that sad. My goodbyes, you know, I wrote letters to everyone. And every time I finished the fight, if I was alive, I'd burn it. But yeah, I mean, you try next time you guys see a video of me walking into the ring before the fight, and now you know how I feel. I think you might be able to feel that energy. And this is a man walking down the ramp to a place that he believes and is accepted that he might die in. The energy, the fear, there's so much emotions. There's many times before my fight, I had to hold back tears, yeah. And it's not because I was scared. It was just the emotion of going to somewhere that you accepted that you will die today.
Yeah, well, you talk about training with the will to die. You should train with the will to die. What does that mean?
Train with the will to die. Train with the acceptance of dying. No, train with the will to die. I mean, what people don't understand is the physical body is so strong. You know, people say that I trained till I dropped. A lot of people trained and dropped because their mindset, there's too much pain, stop already, and they fall on the ground. And these people who fell on the ground and said, I'm done, I'm physically done. If you could look at them and say, hey, if you don't come up and throw 5 more punches, your mom's going to die tomorrow. I guarantee you they're going to get up and throw 5 more punches because they physically can't. It's mental. And train with the will to die. You know, it's like you go in there and you just train and don't let your mind, your weakness of your mind get in the way. I tested myself with that. If you guys ever try it, go into the ring. If you have a heavy bag or you have someone hold mitts for you and kick middle kicks until your body fails and you fall from your body failing. Not your mind chickening off in the pain. Not your mind saying, oh shit, I can't lift my leg as high anymore because I'm so burnt, my legs are burning. You can still kick. You can kick like a girl, but you can still kick. Try that. There's not many people that can do that and kick or punch the mitts until you drop physically. Mentally, you're going to give up before you drop physically. Most people, yeah.
Yeah, it really is about mindset, and it really is about like being able to go past the physical limitations of the body. And also, it's weird because like your mind can hold you back, but so can your body. You know, both can hold each other back. I think they're in like a constant battle of the mind imposing its judgments on the body and the body making the mind feel a certain way, you know, and from being willing to die in the ring to like your runs with Yakuza or anything that you've done. And you have this one quote from your book in chapter 30, where you talk about a certain incident and when someone pulled a gun out on you and your friends. And you talk about how the incident made me realize that the road of the samurai and keeping the honor. And this is before I say this quote, it's something that I think is super important because I think that, sometimes just straight up stupidity and recklessness in our society can be mistaken for bravery and strength when really it might just be that that person has legitimately no control over their emotions and just has to react with whatever they're feeling with, they can't control themselves. So this quote really stood out to me. So you wrote that this incident made me realize that the road of a samurai and keeping the honor of a true man is something that's very hard to do, because just being brave and fearless doesn't necessarily equal honor. Being a crazy kamikaze, putting your life on the line for every little situation, is not honorable. And using your head and finding the best remedy is ideal. And if all that fails, then let your heart and your pride and your honor take over. Then if you have to put your life on the line, so be it. What was it about the situation that really made you realize this? Because essentially it was just like a group of your friends went for like a gang fight, essentially. And then like you had a bat, right? And then this dude pulls out a gun and then everyone decides to run, and you were unsure of whether or not that was the right thing to do. You were unsure if you thought of the Danny incident, and did you learn something from it? I can imagine you contemplating, like, did I just redo a version of that Danny incident? Was that the right thing to do? Which made you contemplate about what does it mean to really live that road of the samurai way of life?
Well, you know, that whole incident was really stupid because we didn't even know what the beef was. I was at the baseball field warming up to play a game. And one of the guys, when we were throwing the ball in the outfield warming up, one of the guys popped his head over the fence and said, "Hey, one of our friends is getting into a fight. We need backup." So me and a couple other guys on the team just ran from there, jumped over the fence with the bats and went over. And I had a real big dilemma after that whole situation, because I was standing in the front with the bat. And our friend was going after the guy. It was obvious the guy didn't want to fight. He kept backing up to his car, to a point where he got to his door. He bent over, and then he came up with the gun. From there, my friend was saying, go ahead, shoot. And I'm standing there like, holy fuck, are we going to actually see my friend get shot in the head? And then my friend kind of backed up as he was saying that right in front of us. And then the guy starts going down the line and just aims a gun at us along the line. And it's like, and I'm standing there like, whoa, am I going to get shot for something that I don't even know what's going on? You know, I don't even know what we're doing here. We're just backing up a friend. And then I remember the gun, right before the gun came past me, shit, the guy next to me just freaking scattered like a cockroach. And right there, it just freaked me out, man. My whole instance was, fuck, run. So I remember running, and then I remember on the side had guys scaling fences, climbing over fences, and I ran down the alley, and I saw a car down the alley. And I'm thinking, okay, I got to get behind that car. And I'm running down the alley thinking, holy shit, I wonder what it's going to feel like to have a bullet coming behind my head. And I'm running, thinking, okay, a little more, boom, and I dive behind the car. Apparently, those guys get up and scatter, but I'm like, it was a real big thing for me that day, you know, thinking like, shit, man. I thought I was a chicken. I thought, okay, everybody else ran. It would be stupid for me to stand there. And then I started thinking, like, why was I there in the first place? There was no real reason. And when I realized that there was no real deep reason for it, I felt like I can't judge myself on that. It might have been the smart thing to do, because you're going to die for what? Because your friend said he needed backup, and you don't know, even he might even be wrong. You know, it changed a lot of things in me. Like, even now, I think from the incidents from that, you know, now whenever I go to back anyone up, I make sure I hear both sides of the story. And then if I believe in my heart that this is the right thing, I'll stand for it. And if it comes down to where it gets really bad, as long as I know the situation and I know in my heart that this is the right thing to do, I'm standing there with a bat in my hand, not even knowing and questioning myself, like, am I doing the right thing? Am I backing up the right person? Did my friend be a dick? Are we being stupid? You know, and when you have so many question marks in your mind on that kind of stuff, I think when that point of, you know, what are you going to do? Fight or flight? I think flight comes in ease faster. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At that moment, it might be the easier solution. You can just totally avoid it. And you think to yourself, why not? You know? And I think that sometimes it is definitely very important to be thinking. But sometimes I had a situation that happened to me the other day that made me think, about it pretty deeply, and I was thinking about how the thinking mind can hinder sometimes the important action that needs to be taken in that moment. When you think too much of the outcome, of course, it depends on the situation. I'm not advocating not thinking, but I think that when you think too much of the outcome, the exact moment to act can just pass you by. Because truly, especially when it comes to anything where your physical body might be in harm, the more you think about it, the less it will make sense, because we're programmed to take care of the physical at all costs. The normal person, it's in our DNA to take care of the physical at all costs. But sometimes the honorable thing to do and the right thing to do involves stepping right into the line of fire, whether it be maybe defending someone who's weaker by someone who, the moment you step in, that person's going to come after you now. And you could have just walked by and forgot about it. And your thinking mind will be like, that person is going to straight up just turn around and come after me. You'll find every reason to not do that thing. It's very hard to go past the hard wiring that's in our DNA. And I think it's a very admirable thing and thing to strive for when you can breach past that, which reminds me of the fasting that you do. You know, I'm into fasting, but I've never done 5 days. And I can imagine the difficulty of it, because I know that once you reach a certain point of fasting, at least for me, your mind will make you realize like every reason why you should just eat. You'll maybe maybe I'll look at myself and I'll tell myself like, I'm going to do like a whole day, 24 hours. And around hour 16, I'm like, or maybe around, let's say hour 20, I'm like, okay, I'm not even overweight. I just trained 3 hours and, the calorie density, I haven't had enough calories. I should eat. And you know, 20 hours is close to 24, and you'll start thinking, and that's your thinking mind making you go against your word. And are you going to die if you keep fasting? Of course you're not. It's 24 hours. In my case, you're going to be fine. So just learn how to overcome that desire. So you doing 5 days, why is it, just so the people who don't really know, why is it that you're, the reasoning behind your fasting? And I wanted to know if you get these feelings of like, maybe I should eat, or is your belief so strong in that moment that is out of the question?
The reason why I fast is because one of my best friends, which is my dog Shuto, he passed of old age. And, you know, he started slowly not being able to hear. He was getting blind, had a hard time walking. But I remember the last 5 days of his life, the only thing he could do is drink water. And I thought, I got to get something into him, because he's getting weaker and weaker. I mean, of course, without food, it even made it worse. So I tried to shove raw meat down his mouth. He wouldn't eat it. And then he passed. He finally passed. And then I remember thinking the first year, when the anniversary came, I remember thinking, oh, fuck, Shuto, rest in peace. And I'm thinking to myself, in my heart, can I really say that to him without knowing what he felt in the last days of his life, you know? I want you to rest in peace, Shuto, but I don't know how much pain you went through at the end of your life. And I felt that it was the best thing for me in my heart to do, that I can really so truly in my heart say, rest in peace. Once I've understood what the pain and the suffering that he went through. So I decided to, from the day, he couldn't eat for 5 days before he passed. So I know those, I'm human, I get the days wrong sometimes. But from the 3rd of March, for the next 5 days until the 7th, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, those 5 days, I just put myself in his situation and just be able to drink water. And I feel, I don't know, for me after that, the 5th day is done, and I almost feel like I can spiritually say to him, have fun in doggy heaven and rest in peace. And like you said about getting those little weaknesses, we get them all the time. You know, my wife, Sarah, she fasted with me.
Oh,
and it's like, I think like a couple years ago, we kind of, you know, the if you ever fast for 5 days, it's the worst. Don't give up on the second, third day. The first 2 days are the worst. That's when your body starts freaking out. Like, where's the food? Where you ain't fucking feeding me, you know? And I remember looking at Sarah and going like, I don't think Shuto would want me to suffer like this. You know?
You know, like, start making those reasonings.
Reasons why not to fast. It's like, he wouldn't be happy seeing me suffer like this, you know?
You'll start thinking, this isn't even healthy. We're meant to eat. I'm going against biology, every reason. And those reasons can straight up stop you from, those thinkings can stop you from doing what you have to do, I think. Or what you should do.
It's that natural human instinct of flight, flight of getting out of this crazy situation. I remember when I did the 880-mile pilgrimage, I remember sitting down one day, like the third day, with the cramps in my legs, the blisters on my feet, thinking, why the hell am I doing this to myself? And from what I find out when I talk to other pilgrims that did the walk, they all have had that feeling. They always ask themselves, I got a car, I got friends, I got a house. Why am I out here walking and trying to find places to sleep?
You know? I was going to ask you, because you do 880 miles.
Yes.
And so how do you do it? You just leave with a backpack?
Yeah, backpack, and pretty much walk the whole thing. And it's a pilgrimage that it's a health pilgrimage. So you visit 108 temples, and most of them are on top of mountains. So yeah, that pilgrimage is incredible, man. I mean, I recommend, if anybody has that time, that freedom to do it, I recommend everyone do it. It's life changing.
When you do the pilgrimage, what is in your backpack?
I get so we got like a tarp, not a tarp. What is that called? It's something to cover your bag when it rains. Yeah, I have a little aerobics mat, like a real thin mat to sleep on. Pretty much a change of shirt, change of socks, band-aids in case I get band-aid the blisters. I get my suntan lotion. Hey, get out of my face. My lotion. I have sunscreen. That's Bernie, by the way.
Yeah, see, I see him on your Instagram. Your two dogs are always chilling, man.
Yeah, so, and sunscreen, you know, just some basic necessities. Okay. And you know, it's funny, the first pilgrimage I went on, I packed my bag. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to carry the bag. I'm going to make it as light as possible. I'm going to bring only the basic necessities, and I pack shit. And I didn't, you know, before the pilgrimage, I practiced for it. I went and walked like 12 miles a day, kind of. And I did not carry no backpack. I didn't realize. Have you guys ever did runs with backpacks, man?
I've done a little bit of rucking.
Holy shit. The pain in your shoulders from the backpack.
Yeah.
Wait, outweighs the blisters and the cramps in the legs, man. So it was funny because when I packed the backpack, at the, I think temple 12, I threw out half the shit I had in there. I swear I took the big bare necessities, but I took out half the shit and I donated it to the temple. But you know what's real crazy is that pilgrimage, when I first heard about it, like 880 miles, and it's not like flat road. Yeah, it's all mountains. Yeah. So I'm thinking, wow, that sounds tough, but I've heard a lot of people do it. So I'm like, that's real intriguing to me, but a lot of people do it. So it's not, you know, for me, the challenge is something that you can't do it. So then I thought, okay, what if I put restrictions on myself where I couldn't buy food and I couldn't pay money for a place to sleep. And I thought, well, waters were important. It was the Japan summers are really hot. And I thought, okay, I gotta buy water. So what I did with myself was I packed myself with some, you know, some army, you know, those dry packs they have that you add water and becomes a meal. Mm-hmm. So I had 8 of those. So I had 8 days of food. And I started off the walk like that. And when the food ran out, I had to just walk without food and find a way to get food. Or, you know, that pilgrimage really, really famous where you wear white, you carry a sue, a stick, you wear the hat. And people know you're a pilgrim and they'll donate food to you. They'll take you into the house to sleep. So that pilgrimage, the reason why I believe the pilgrimage will help you grow as a person is because, you know, in life, when you go through life, sometimes you go through this mental anguish where your job's so hard, you know, you're just mentally breaking down all the pressure from the job. There's also something you have to, like an emotional pain, emotional stress, where either someone you really care about passes away, or you lose a girlfriend that you would have died for, you love her, but she doesn't want to be with you anymore. Or the other type of pain you get is physical. So there's mental, emotional, and physical. And, you know, a lot of times in life gets really hard, where people like just want to give up on life. And a lot of times they're hit with two at one time. Yeah, never really three at one time. But the pilgrimage, man, it's really interesting because you get hit with mental, physical, and emotional suffering at a very, very extreme level at one time. And you got to overcome that. You know, I mean, the pilgrimage, you almost feel homeless. You go through these waves on the pilgrimage because the blisters start and you feel like, fuck, I cannot walk anymore. And then you continue to walk and you realize that it's painful and you might have to walk a little slower. You might have to curve your feet this way because the blisters on that side, but you still can walk. The cramps start happening and you feel like most of the times, like, I'm cramping too much. I got to stop walking. But you maybe walk a little slower now, but you still can walk. And, you know, there's just all these things that you go through in the pilgrimage. You know, like, I didn't pay for housing, so I had to find a space to sleep outside every night. At 5 o'clock, when the temple is closed, before dark, I want to find a good place to sleep. So if it rains, 70% of the places you can sleep disappear. So finding a place to sleep is like really hard. You know, you got to find a peaceful place. If there's wind, you want at least two walls. You know, you want at least a right angle. You want something to be get into a corner from the wind. You need something to cover for the rain. You need to be up on something because there's snakes and critters that can come fuck with you when you sleep. You know, so there's all these little things. And, man, you know, going through the pilgrimage, not being able to talk to people. You go in there and you're starting to stink because your backpack starts accumulating all the sweat. You feel like a homeless person. So sometimes you don't have food for 2 or 3 days and you're just dying for food. You know, people can you a piece of bread. They're like, you cherish the bread, you eat it. You know, there's so many things that in that pilgrimage that you go through that I've learned, and I've learned to be it's made me a much happier person. And how I'm going to explain that is, I tell people this, like, you know, in your life, you have everything, every single thing in your life, you can put in a circle, a category, three different circles. One circle is things that make you happy. The second circle is things that don't matter. You know, things that make me happy, jujitsu, listening to nice music, eating ice cream, you know, things that make me happy. Things that doesn't matter, like the bag hanging on the wall right there. You know, well, today was a nice day. I didn't realize it was a nice day. It didn't really matter. And then you got these things in the last circle that really irritate you, like rude people, traffic. Go to a restaurant you want to eat and there's like a freaking 1 hour wait, you know. All these things that make a little bad energy in your day. What I found from the pilgrimage was that the circles changed. So, for example, when you guys went into bed last night, you guys were probably thinking about what happened in that day or what you're going to do tomorrow or shit. It's already 1 o'clock. I got to wake up at 7. I'm only going to get 6 hours. You know, different stuff you think about. Yeah. But after coming home from the pilgrimage where I had to find a place to sleep, and that little thin aerobics mat that I had felt like a bed when I didn't sleep on it, it felt hard. But then when you have that little thin mat, it felt super soft. But when you wake up in the morning, you realize, like, holy shit, that was pretty hard, you know? You know, for me, even today, when I get into bed, I know that if it rains, I don't need to move. I know that I got blankets to cover if I get cold. I'm jumping into a soft bed. And I'm sitting there getting tucked in, laying in bed, and feeling super happy. That I know that every day in my life, I'm going to have a nice soft bed to sleep in with a roof over my head. So getting into bed before didn't matter to me. I'm tired. Oh, shit. I got to get to sleep. I got to get up tomorrow. Got to get into bed. So you got to get into bed. And it was in the circle that didn't matter to me. Now that's in the circle that makes me happy. Another thing that goes into my, you know, like something that really irritated me was waiting in line. I remember after the pilgrimage, I was waiting in line. A long line. And there was a lot of Chinese travelers that were coming to Japan at the time. And they were buying stuff at the pharmacist. And I was lining up to buy a drink. And there was like maybe 8 or 9 people in front of me. I'm like, shit, standing in line. I hate standing in line. What made it worse was I was standing in line. These Chinese were letting their friends go in front of us. Like, okay, you cut in front of me. It's okay. You can go. Like, oh, okay, now there's 9 people in front of me. Oh, now there's 10 people in front of me. And back here before the pilgrimage, for me, it would have been like, I'm going to be assertive. And I'm going to go talk to these people or talk to the people at the girl at the register and tell them they're cutting. We're waiting. They got to wait in the back. And of course, doing that would give me a little bit of irritability. And I was standing there looking at the whole situation, thinking like, oh, these damn Chinese, why are they cutting in line? And then right there, it kind of dawned on me like, holy shit, what am I doing? I'm buying a cold drink. I never had a cold drink during the pilgrimage. I'm buying a cold drink. I'm standing in air condition. I'm going to wait another extra 5 minutes maybe. And after this is done, I'm jumping in my car. I don't have to walk 16 hours. And right there, I realized like, oh shit, this ain't that bad. I'll stand in line in the air conditioner buying a cold drink and going to probably go jump in my car and listen to music as I sit on my ass and I cover kilos. No, like covering 3 kilos on a walk is hardcore. Traveling 3 kilometers in a car, sitting on your ass, listening to music ain't shit, you know? Mm-hmm. And right there, I was standing there in line thinking, shit, what's another 5 minutes standing in aircon waiting for my cool drink to be drunk, you know? Yeah. And that I realized that, you know, traffic or standing in line with people cutting made me, it used to irritate me, and it's come into the circle. It doesn't make me happy, but it went into the circle where it didn't really matter. So the circle of things that made me happy got a lot bigger. The circle that didn't matter stayed the same, because as things moved out of there and went to happiness, the irritability circle transferred a lot of things from there to the things that didn't matter. And I believe I get a lot more times of happiness now.
Yeah, I truly think that hitting these so-called rock bottoms in life is crucial. And I think everyone should, in a way, because, you know, we, like, especially now as a society, we're so accustomed to these pleasures and like luxuries and comforts, you know, that we forget that there's that side. And when we do hit that side, we don't know how to handle it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I've been working as a plumber for 6 years, and I'm finally going to take like a 2-week vacation next month. And, you know, the average person would be like, oh, I'm booking a trip to like, you know, the Caribbean or like a nice resort. But me personally, I'm going to fill a backpack with the most minimal thing. And I want to go all the way out to Utah, like not really have a destination in mind, just kind of wing it. And like, I tell this to my coworkers and they're like, yo, you're crazy. That's like a struggle. That's not a vacation. What are you doing? Like, yeah, and I'm doing it on a motorcycle. So like, yo, it's painful. Like, what are you doing, man? And I'm like, yo, to me, honestly, that's nirvana. That's a utopia. Like, I'm going to feel so happy in those moments, just winging it, like knowing that I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I don't have enough clothes. I don't know where I'm going to get food from. Like, it's amazing, you know? And I think everyone should do, like you said, like a pilgrimage to feel and really, because when you come back from these trips, you truly do appreciate, like you said, the simple pleasures of having a bed. Now people have the most comfortable beds, thousands and thousands of dollars, and they're not happy with it, you know? But it's something we need to break out of and definitely learn to appreciate. Just have simple gratitude for things. I read somewhere where if you wake up and you say three things you're grateful for as soon as you wake up, you're going to have a better day. And this energy and conditioning will accumulate to the point where you just become a better person and you're more satisfied with little things. Like, I remember me and him, we have this thing where we just walk around and appreciate little things, like somebody's little garden, like little things that somebody just walking by every day would just pass, you know, mindlessly, thinking maybe of negative situations like their day, but just little things, putting value is, I think that's the meaning of life, you know, in a way.
Yeah. There's so many things that people overlook. Yeah. That really is meant to be appreciated.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I want to say that I've never been to Japan, but I've read so much. Like, one of my favorite books is the Hagukare, and I just love like the fighting spirit, the like overcoming yourself idea. I love all of that. It's helped me find a lot of peace in my everyday life. And when I read your book a while ago, it really did help me. You said in your book that if you can do something with your life, because you're going to die, that can help other people, and they can, like, you have ideas and what other people will feel when you die. I just want you to know that me personally, it's affected me on like a pretty deep level. I have a bunch of your stuff underlined, and I, you know, it's one of the books that I go back to read and to try to apply like a small sentence to my everyday life. And I want to like eventually soon, like within the next year, hopefully if things relax, I want to visit Japan. I want to like see all these things. I want to like train at Purebred. I want to like do all these things. So hopefully if things ever clear up, I can make it out there. Like, we can make it out there. And I just want to say thank you so much for speaking on the show. It really means a lot to us. And the way you live your life has positively affected the way that I think and live my life.
Corona will be under control soon. You will probably come to Japan. We will meet. I'll take you to dinner. And thank you for having me. Yeah. Thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for what you guys do for MMA. And we know a lot of stuff we talked about today. Like, I had the prison. We didn't talk about my prison sentence, but my pilgrimage. I'm in the process of editing book two now.
Oh, awesome, man!
And book two covers a lot of that. So I was actually, when I wrote the book, I actually wrote in chronological order, where from when I started, from childhood. And by the time I got it, I had like 120 words. I was like, holy shit, it's only like 2005. And I had to stop that book. So I started the next one. So it'll continue on from 2005, which consists of a lot of deep stuff. I think a lot deeper than the fights.
Okay, amazing. I can't wait. Once you have it, I'll definitely read it. I'm looking forward to it, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Right on, man.
Thank you, guys. Inspiration. If you guys get this link, send it to me so I'll share it on my pages.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
You guys have a good one, man.
Yeah. Peace.